DTI, see also the officials from Department of Tourism, also morning to parliamentary staff. Today we have two departments, Department of Trade and Industry and Competition. Still a new device, still not familiar with it actually. Also we have a Department of Tourism. We will be starting with the Department of Tourism at 10:30. Just a background, last week we received a briefing from Department of Trade and Industry on the economic partnership agreement between Southern African Customs Union and Mozambique, together with or together it's called SACUM and the United Kingdom. At the time we had an understanding that we should have even in the House dealt with this particular EPA because the deadline for Brexit was the 31st of October. We experienced problem of a quorum, especially when Honorable Bosov had to leave to go to another meeting, and also Honorable Matevula. And though we had the full presentation, but we could not take a decision on the endorsement of the agreement because we had less than five provinces. When we were to decide to have it the next day, but we then received new developments that there has been an agreement that the Brexit deadline has been shifted to January 2020. And that then gave us some time and then to schedule this meeting today. But we will be reducing it to 30 minutes altogether so that by 10:30 then we start with the Department of Tourism on their annual report. Let me start with the internal matters, the introductions and the apologies. Firstly, let me introduce myself. My name is Mandla Khai. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Trade and Industry, Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment and Labour. Those are the departments that report to this committee, so it's named after the department that account to this committee. We still don't have a name for it, except that the names are according to the departments that we oversight. I will allow honorable members to introduce themselves, and followed by parliamentary staff members, and then the department of DTI. Department of Tourism will introduce themselves later when we start with the department. So thank you very much.
My name is Kenny Muimang, member of this committee from Northern Cape.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. My name is Honorable Lydia Mshodi from the Free State Province. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Tim Bradisett from the Great Province of KZN. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Mohammed Dango from Gauteng.
Good morning, everybody. Sonia Bosov and Mpumalanga.
Morning, Jacques Lontje from the Western Cape.
Good morning. My name is Maria Solomons. I'm the committee secretary to this committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm North Stewart Denise Zulu, the committee secretary.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ludwig Schmidt, colleague advisor for the committee.
Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'm Shamara Ali, the procedural officer from the NCLP.
Good morning. I'm Abdullah Hanif, researcher to the committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Enrico Wazir, and I'm the committee assistant.
TTI.
Good morning, all. I'm Xavier Karim, Deputy Director General in the International Trade and Economic Development in the TTI.
Good morning. My name is Lord Sanders from the Department of Trade.
Are you the only two from TTI? The rest is from Torres? No. Then can you introduce yourself?
Sure, yes. Josh Reed from British Consulate.
Good morning. My name is Mukhese Mwema. I'm from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much. DDG, as I indicated, I will give you 15 minutes. We have had the presentation, but for the benefit of those who are not here, we will start afresh. But I'm going to limit the time to 15 minutes, allow the other 15 minutes for questions, for clarity, and also a decision on this particular economic partnership agreement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair, and again, good morning to all the honourable members. It is an honour to have this opportunity to present to you an outline of the agreement that we've just concluded between the Southern African Customs Union, Mozambique, together. As you mentioned, we now refer to ourselves as SACUM. And on the one side, and we concluded the negotiations with the United Kingdom on the other side. I've taken note. I'll try to go very quickly through the presentation, but the presentation, I believe, has been circulated, so members will have the full presentation in front of them. We know the background, that the UK had voted to leave the EU in 2016. At that point, they were given 2 years in terms of the EU treaty to negotiate the terms of the exit and to negotiate a new arrangement. And as you've mentioned, the Chair, the UK was set to leave on the 31st of October. Well, the first time around was in the end of March, but there was an extension at that point. The second deadline for an extension, for a deadline to leave, was the 31st of October. That was the terms of that agreement was not accepted by the UK Parliament in March and then again in October, and the UK was obliged to request the EU to grant another extension, and you'd mentioned all of this in your opening remarks. We now are looking at a deadline of the 31st of January when the UK would leave the EU. But in the interim, we've also seen that there is UK Parliament has agreed to general elections in December this year. We'll discuss, of course, there'll be many things that would be that would play into those elections, including whether or not the UK finally decides to remain or to leave the EU. We looked at the terms of the withdrawal agreement that was on offer, which has not been accepted yet by the UK Parliament. And if those terms were accepted, it would mean that the UK would remain part of the EU in terms of trade relations until the end of 2020. So it's there's an extended period of continuing current trade relations under the current withdrawal agreement. But it's also true that the UK remains deeply divided on whether to remain in the EU or to leave. And if it leaves, then on what terms? And the uncertainty on these matters has been pervasive. I think we're all aware. We've all seen the debates in the media. A great deal of uncertainty as to whether or not the UK will indeed leave, and if it does leave, on what terms. And this creates a great deal of uncertainty the UK's trade relations with third parties, and that includes with South Africa, with the Southern African Customs Union, and with Mozambique in addition, so SACU-M. As I indicated, the new withdrawal agreement would extend the current arrangements to the end of 2020 if it was accepted. But that essentially, what that does is essentially delays a decision on what happens to our trade relations in 2020 if the withdrawal agreement as it currently stands was agreed by the UK Parliament. And I think in summary, the essential point to make from all of this is that there's been a great deal of uncertainty about the future of South Africa, SACU, Mozambique's trade relations with the UK, given this background. And it's against this background that the importance of this new agreement with the UK needs to be considered. And I think one of the best ways of understanding it is to see it as an insurance against a situation where the UK leaves the EU without any agreement. A little bit more background, the trade between ourselves, South Africa, SACU and Mozambique has been established under the agreement that we have with the EU that came into force in 2016. This was also a very long negotiation, but we concluded in 2016, entered into force in 2016, and that's the basis of the trade agreement that we've been trading with all of Europe, including the UK. In that negotiations, we were called the SADC-EPA group, and it includes Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Namibia, and Mozambique. And under that agreement, we had negotiated extensive preferential access to the EU market on a whole range of products, except for aluminum products and some agricultural products. We also had specific rules of origin that were negotiated as part of this, and that essentially defines the level of how much of the product has to be locally produced in order to obtain the preferential access set out in the Economic Partnership Agreement. Traditional parts of a trade agreement include trade remedies to deal with unfair trade. That's established in the agreement with the EU under the Economic Partnership Agreement. We have another trade remedy is a safeguard that allows us to increase the duties on imports where there is a threat of injury to the local market. And as I'd mentioned, as being part of the EU all of these years, the UK was part of this arrangement, and we traded with all of the EU countries, including the UK, under this arrangement. The risk arose that if the UK exits the EU customs union arrangements, it's no longer party to the SADC, to the EU SADC Economic Partnership Agreement, and our trade would revert to WTO tariff rates, and those are not preferential. They would mean that we would be in a less favorable position vis-a-vis the EU, vis-a-vis other countries that have trade relations with the UK. So to avoid this, there was an early agreement, principled agreement, around 2 years ago between our ministers at the time, that we seek to roll over the terms of the SADC EU Economic Partnership Agreement into a agreement between SACU, Mozambique, and the UK. So there was a principled agreement that we started to work on that. The next slides simply just outline the importance of our trade. I won't go into all the details here. The figures are there. I'll just draw your attention to one figure. You'll see that in the total figure that we have here for total trade between South Africa and the UK We say that it is in 2018 101.2 billion rand. There's a discrepancy here from other figures, and that has to do with the figures that we use come from the South African Revenue Services, and they don't include all gold. So some gold exports are excluded, and that accounts for the difference. The minister last week, I think, would have presented, or will present, certainly at the media event, the figure he mentioned is 140 billion rand. This number doesn't include some gold products. So UK is a very important trading partner, very important export market for South Africa, and so it's important that we preserve our trade relations and preserve the preferential access that we currently enjoy. I'd mentioned the essential agreement between the ministers in 2017 was a rollover of the agreement, of the terms of the agreement, that it should mirror to the extent possible the current terms, that this would be a technical exercise rather than an attempt to renegotiate the agreement, and we would try to limit the changes to areas where it was absolutely necessary to make certain adjustments given the changes. I will skip these others. I think in summary, if we were to just make a quick summary of the agreement itself, if you were to compare the new agreement that we have with the UK with the agreement that we had with the EU, they're almost identical. It's almost word for word. It was almost a cut and paste of the one agreement into the other, except for a few critical areas. And that had to do with tariff. The one important area was tariff rate quotas. And tariff rate quotas are a mechanism for trade where you don't open up all your trade to the other partner. You don't open up your market to the other partner. You indicate that they can, for instance, if it's it could be wheat, and you could say we would allow zero duties on wheat imports from any country, but up to a certain limited amount of tonnage. So it's a tariff preference, but for a limited amount of products. Now, we had that with the EU, where we'd given the EU a quota. Now, with the UK moving out, we had to allocate a certain portion of that just for the UK now. So that was the kind of the technical exercise that we had to go through. From the UK side, the most important thing for them in this negotiations is that because they're so deeply integrated into production processes with the EU in terms of their exports, so a lot of what they export, they use inputs from the rest of the European Union into their production process, which they then export. They wanted us to recognize those inputs from the EU as part of their exports, and we do the same. We import from the EU, it goes into our production processes, it's exported to the UK. So in principle, we agreed to that. There was a matter of the bilateral safeguard measures, which was another serious problem towards the end of the negotiations. We currently have a safeguard duty against poultry imports from the EU. And that has to do with a significant increase in imports from the EU over the last 4 or 5 years, and that has caused injury to the domestic industry. So we've put a safeguard on a duty against imports from the EU on poultry. Now, when the UK was leaving, we had to make sure that it continued to apply to the UK if they were to leave the EU. That became a matter of intense negotiations at the end, but we managed to agree that the existing duty that is in place would continue to apply. There are some other transitional arrangements about at the moment the UK leaves, how does trade continue to flow even though the documentation may be old documentation and we don't have the new documentation for the UK. So some, again, very technical matters, but can be commercially significant. And then we had to negotiate what we call a built-in agenda, which is future work. Once this agreement is in place, what would we look at in future? So those were the key differences that you would see in the new agreement as compared to the agreement that we had with the EU. I've mentioned the tariff rate quotas. We have about 13 tariff rate quotas that we have an interest in. The UK has about, if I'm not mistaken, did I get that right? Eight. So these are the tariff rate quotas. These are details of how many tons and what we agreed with the UK TRQs on South African products, South African TRQs on UK products. This is the question of the UK and South Africa and SACO being able to take inputs from the rest of the EU in terms of our trade. I mentioned the treatment of bilateral safeguards, the transitional measures, and the built-in agenda, and the way forward. The key question remains whether or not the UK finally decides to leave the EU or not. The deadline for that in terms of what is currently on the table looks like it would be the end of January next year. Of course, there is the elections in December, and it's unclear what those elections will result in, whether or not there would be a confirmation of the intention to leave or a reversal of the decision, and then everything is would have to be discussed again. What we have done is, whatever happens, a lot of that is outside, that's out of our hands. If the UK was to leave, if it was to leave without a deal at the end of January, if it was to leave at the end of 2020, what we've managed to do is to have in place an agreement that in those circumstances we can be sure that our trade with the UK would remain intact on that. And so I think, Chair, the essential point to say is this is an insurance policy, so to speak. It will protect our trade. It may not be necessary depending on what happens in future, but we need to have it in place on our side to protect ourselves for whatever eventuality was to emerge. So with that, I should maybe also say that national ratification processes like ours are underway in other member countries, in SACU, rest of SACU, Mozambique. The UK itself doesn't need a full ratification process at this stage. It has a parliamentary procedural mechanism for provisional application. So once we ratify, the UK could provisionally implement almost immediately. So they don't need to go through that. They can ratify after the provisional ratification. And with all of these understandings, we would recommend that the committee look favorably on this agreement for ratification, for the full ratification process. I hope I have kept it short enough, Chair.
Thank you very much, DDG, for the presentation. Just before we decide, I'll just check if honorable members would like to pose questions for clarity. Honorable Tim, Honorable Dango, Honorable Moima, in that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I was hoping that given the events of the past weekend, we could push for more preferential rates now that we are the world champions over our partners in this deal. That's just a general comment, Chair. Just a bit of humour, Chair, at our friend's expense. Chair, look, I think your presentation makes it clear that the December elections are by no means going to necessarily resolve this problem. We could well have a hung parliament in England. I can't see how the fortunes are going to shift that much. And also we have the spectre as well that Scotland are particularly upset with the entire Brexit arrangement and may well split away. So the question just simply is I understand you summed it up very well by saying this is an insurance policy. Is it literally just that, or are we at the point where we're committing ourselves to some future uncertain event? Or is this literally just a backstop, to use that term, which has been often quoted in the whole debate? Is this just a backstop, or are we committing resources, agreements, signing agreements on a future uncertain event? And also, the second question is as a result of this, we might see the referendum again in Scotland, because Scotland are certainly not happy with this entire arrangement, and they might push for that into their referendum again to leave the UK. And then, you know, have we thought that far ahead? That's all. Thank you.
Good question. Honourable Dung?
Yeah, President. I think we had a very extensive briefing in the last week. And I think there's new questions coming out after the weekend, which doesn't alter very much. Having said that, I think we're not disadvantaged in any way by actually acceding to this agreement. In fact, it's an insurance policy that takes us forward, just in case. Now, the question is, the just in case there is no Brexit, what happens then? With that, Chairperson, I think we should move ahead and see to it and adopt it today. Thank you. The other question is, can we now call champagne?
Okay. Honourable Moima.
Thank you, Chair. Currently, so the divisions indicated that this is an insurance on trade relations, and that failure on the Brexit will revert to WTO. I just want to check in terms of other conventions of the EU outside trade relations. Is there a separate process that deals with that? Obviously, there will be. I know that UK also adopting EU Convention on Human Rights, it also impacted on them on the issue of particularly on the issue of the rule of law. With the recent development in the Supreme Court in the UK setting aside the decision by the Prime Minister to suspend Parliament, which is directly linked to this. There was also an issue raised around the impact of the EU Convention on Human Rights on the parliamentary system of the UK. I think the question is, with regard to other conventions that might not be related to trade relations, is there a separate process that runs parallel to this or what?
Are there any other questions from other members? Honourable Lansman.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to know, with the latest announcement by the President on the approach of appointing advisory council, and also with a new person appointed to focus on the investment issues, and with that former deputy minister, former minister, and but it's specifically speaking about tourism. How is the working relations going to be? Is there a plan, or is it in silos?
Follow-up question.
Just came to my mind that there is a particular issue in relation to the UK and the EU being split up, and that is a component issue. I'm sure you're aware. So we might be selling vehicles, let's say BMWs or VWs from South Africa there, but there's certain components that are made elsewhere in the world. So you have a complete product, but it has various components. And that's going to create a clash between the EU and the UK deal. Can you just comment on that and what difficulties you see in regard to the finished product with South African parts or a component of it, and how that will affect the relationship of the EU and the UK if Brexit does happen?
Any others? Okay. Just for me, if other countries who are members of SACOM, for example, do not ratify this agreement before the deadline, what is going to happen? Is each country then going to have a bilateral relationship with the UK, or is it should be a collective agreement that includes all of them? With that, you can then respond to the question.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to all the members for very, very good questions. Maybe on the, I don't know if we get more preferential, probably get worse after Saturday. I think the question about whether or not we are committing to something in future that is uncertain, maybe inadvertently, it's a fair question. I suppose what we're trying to do in this agreement is simply lock in what we currently have. Of course, there are lots of possibilities that the trade in future could not meet our expectations. There could be changes to the UK's environmental policies or its health policies, and that could make it more difficult for our exports. So, to the extent that we're trying to maintain the current arrangement, that is the effort. If those were to happen in future where there were new challenges to our exports, then we'd have to deal with that in terms of the agreement. The agreement does provide for a dispute settlement. It would allow us to react in certain ways. We didn't think through perhaps very precisely on what would happen to Scotland if Scotland was to leave, and we haven't disaggregated our trade between England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland. But presumably, if Scotland was to leave, they would do so in the context of the EU, and so then our trade agreement with the EU would presumably cover that. There was a question on
the multi components.
This was the point I would say about the point that we agreed with the UK, because they are also so deeply integrated with the EU production.
Sorry, I just want to indicate to the Department of Tourism, I know we said we're starting with you at 10:30, so I want to just apologize, we're still dealing with another matter from DGI. As soon as we're done, then we will start with the presentation of tourism. Okay.
Thank you. With the components, you're right. For instance, auto companies in South Africa produce for Africa, produce for South Africa, produce for EU. Some of those components come from the UK into the process here. We have been exporting to the EU. Products we call it cumulation. The technical term is cumulation. So you cumulate with products, say, from the EU in South African production processes for export to the UK. That has been preserved. The open question for the moment is whether or not products that we import from the UK into production processes in South Africa for export to the EU, whether or not that would still receive preferential access. But that is in part dependent on an agreement between the EU and the UK. So there's a risk to our trade in that respect. And we'd have to talk to the EU, but what would solve it is if the EU and the UK reach their agreement. I think it's in everyone's interest that those value chains are maintained. In the context, I think the question was, if I hope I got it right, if the question was what happens if there is no Brexit, then the agreement doesn't need to come into force. And there are different types of Brexits, the different possibilities. If the UK was to leave the EU but remain part of the customs union component, then you wouldn't need this agreement. Our current arrangement would leave. So there are different types of Brexits that can occur. But from a trade perspective, the key issue is if the UK was to leave the customs arrangements of the EU, then we would need this agreement to maintain trade. If they don't, this agreement is we keep it in our back pocket, so to speak. I'm not qualified, unfortunately, to talk about other conventions, and I'm not so sure if there's a procedure around there, whether or not this is a UK-EU discussion or it's a broader discussion, but I believe our colleagues from the Department of International Relations may be better placed to answer that question. I apologize for that. The final question that I was on tourism, on investment, this was not dealt with directly in the context of the negotiations and the agreement that we're putting forward to the committee today, but there are, I know that there are processes around investment promotion activities, and I'm sure colleagues from Department of Tourism will speak to the tourism issues much more knowledgeable than I am on that matter. And Chair, I think you posed the question about what happens if some countries don't. All our procedures are a little different. Botswana, for instance, when their minister signs the agreement, which she did in October, in terms of their procedure, it enters into force. So Botswana has effectively ratified with the signature of their minister. Namibia is close to us. They have to go through exactly the same process. Given the extension, it would surprise me very much if there's a delay. I think everyone will be able to ratify. But what we did in this agreement is if one doesn't ratify for whatever reason, it's not going to hold back the others. And we have another insurance policy called a memorandum of understanding. If for any reason one country doesn't ratify in time, we will continue the trade relations until they ratify. So we try to cover all the different scenarios on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, now that the clarities have been responded to, we going down to decide as to whether we recommend the NCOP plenary to ratify this economic partnership agreement. I'll do that by then reading the report of the Select Committee on Trade and Industry, Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment, and Labour on the Economic Partnership Agreement, EPA, between South African Customs Union, SACU, and Mozambique together called SACUM, and the United Kingdom dated 5 November 2019. Having considered the economic partnership agreement between SACUM and the United Kingdom, referred to it, recommend that the Council, in terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution, approve the said economic partnership agreement. Can we have a mover and a second? Honorable Dango, Honorable Musodi, second. So that is the decision of this committee, honorable members. This will then be 80 seats, and from there it will then be programmed so that we table the report in the House, and then the House will decide whether to ratify it or not. But what we'll be doing as a committee will be making a recommendation to the House. And thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you very much, CDG. Now, the committee decision is to recommend to the House. So you'll then hear as we go along when it is going to be programmed and then when it's going to be ratified by the NCOP. I know the committee of NA has already recommended, but though it has not yet been programmed to go to the House as yet. Yeah, thank you very much for coming to present. Thank you. Just a 5-minute break, honorable members, before we start with the Department of Tourism. 5 minutes break. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to Department of Tourism, DG, and the DGs and the other executive managers of the Department of Tourism. We will quickly start with the introductions. I know we've done it when we're dealing with the DTI, but this is another meeting. My name is Mandla Khai. I'm the chairperson of Select Committee on Trade and Industry Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment and Labor. So those are the 5 departments that this committee oversight for now, because it also includes the economic development, but I think up to the 31st of March. I will allow honorable members to introduce themselves.
Eric Landsman, on behalf of Northwest.
Morning. My name is Kenny Mwima, member of the committee from Northern Cape.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. My name is Honorable Lydia Mshodi from the Free State Province. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. Tim Bradisset, member of the committee from KZN. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Muhammad Dango from Gauteng.
Good morning, everybody. Sonia Basov and Mpumalanga.
Morning, Yakulong from the Western Cape.
Good morning. My name is Nadia Solomons, Committee Secretary to the Committee.
Morning, everyone. My name is Ludo Masashua, the Content Advisor for the Committee.
Good morning. My name is Belen Moshadarzeta for the Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Abdullah Hanif. I'm a researcher for the Committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Enrico Bazir, and I'm the Committee Assistant.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members and Colleagues. My name is Victor Tarage. I'm the DG for the Department of Tourism.
Morning, Chairperson. Morning, Members. Ralph Ackerman, CFO.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. My name is Lula Maduma. I'm the DDG responsible for corporate management.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. My name is Morongwa Rampeli. I'm the DDG for Tourism Sector Support Services.
Good morning, I'm Carnita Tsuka. I'm with the Department of Tourism, Port Health. Gentleman next to you.
Good morning, my name is Mukhese Mwema. I'm a representative from Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we have apologies. Is apology from Honourable Brenda Matevula, unable to attend the meeting. Two other apologies. I was phoned by Minister of Tourism on Thursday. She indicated that she won't be able to attend. There's an investment conference that is starting today until Thursday that she is part of. But also the deputy minister, she indicated that he will be in America, in the United States of America. She apologized that both of them won't be able to attend, but she assured us that the Director General of the Department will be part of the meeting, and he is here. Also, let me also take the opportunity for myself that I've also been invited to the investment conference, and that I'll be leaving around 11:45. If we're not done by that time, and ask the Honourable Moimang to take the chair. So those are the apologies, Honourable Members. I've just indicated to the DG, because there's also another issue before we start with the annual report presentation, Honourable Members, that we indicated last week that there's a legislation that was dealt with in the last term, the legislation on the National Gambling Amendment Bill. You remember that there was a presentation that was done in the beginning of this year, sixth term, and before we then could proceed with the bill processes, there was an indication that the bill was not formally revived by the NCOP. So we had to stop with the process. And then about, I think, 2 weeks ago, all the bills were then resuscitated by the House. Now we had agreed that the week of the 18th to the 22nd will be visiting our provinces, because it's a Section 76 bill. We will be going to our provinces to, together with the department, to brief our provinces. But in terms of the process, is that the way the resolution that was taken by the House, the way it is crafted, is that all these bills will proceed from where they were left off in the last term. That crafting is giving some problem specifically now with regard to this particular bill. It may be fine with other bills, but for this particular one, as we indicated that last time, the challenge was that with regard to the mandates that were coming from provinces, There were two provinces that could not submit their mandates, final mandates on time. And those that submitted caused a stalemate in that out of the seven that submitted their mandates, three voted for and the three voted against, and then there was one abstention. And that left us in a stalemate as such that bill could not go to the House as a report because of the stalemate. So that's where we left it at. Now, with the capturing of the resolutions, when it says the bills will continue from where they were left off, they were discussing and also legal advice from Parliament and also from the procedural table of staff, that given that we have new members here as a committee, and also there are new members in the provinces, also new speakers, the new chairpersons of committees in the legislatures, that we should go back and again brief the provinces. But then it will be up to the provinces that should decide as to whether they want to still hold public hearings on the bill or not. Then we will take it through. All that we'll be doing is just to present together with the department, and then we highlight to the committees in the legislatures whether they would like to have public hearings or not. And then we'll leave it at that. But I'm going to suggest that, I'm just highlighting this because I may not be part of the meeting to the finish of the meeting. So I just wanted to indicate so that after we finish then with the annual report, we can then go back to this issue and have a clarity on it. I thought that Samara will be because she was here, she would, from the table staff, she would also indicate. But the discussion I had is that with her, that there will be letter that will be written to, that will be on my name to the committees, but also there will be letter that was written by the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces to the speakers of the provinces. To clarify these matters. But for now, we should not be discussing. We can discuss it after the presentation of the of the annual report of tourism. With that, I'll hand over to you, DJ. Thank you for allowing this time. We're supposed to have started at 10, but we had to deal with this issue of Brexit. I'm sure you are also affected because if we don't have an agreement with the UK, and then we won't have tourism relations. So that's why we had to deal with it, and then before the deadline of the, it was extended from the 31st of October to the end of January 2020. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We fully understand. We are one government presenting to one parliament. So, and we are also, as tourism, we are part of the international relations clustered committee. So it's matters what you were discussing we are familiar with, and we would want exactly what is going to happen with it as well. Thank you. We have a presentation. Ordinarily, we would have gone for a process that the DDGs and the CFO would have presented parts. But I took note of the issue raised with time, both in terms of the remaining allocated time, but also in terms of your own specific time before we finalize. So I'm going to attempt to run through the presentation, all of it, and try to see if we cannot save some of that time. is going to cover the outcomes of the audit, financial information, the program performance across the various programs. We've got four programs in the organization. I'm mindful that this is a new term of Parliament. So we'll go slightly into a little bit of detail. Our four programs is corporate management, which is program one, standard program one. And then we've got a program that deals with tourism research policy and international relations. And the program that deals with destination development. So this is where we'll be dealing with capital projects and so on. And I think we'll have a lot to talk about that today. And tourism sector support services, ranging from either tourist guiding, skills development, visitor information, and so on. The list goes on. And then we'll also share the information with regards to the HR information of the organization overall. Unfortunately, for the first time, we got a qualified audit report for the very, very first time. It's been coming for a long time, let me put it like that. What had happened was we had projects, capital projects, some dating back before the establishment of the current Department of Tourism. So they would have come from the time when we were still Environmental Affairs and Tourism. And those particular projects, they get implemented, they get to literally a dead end, and then there's a request to say, we need more money from the implementing agent. And when you ask what is this more money for, they say so that we can complete the project. But originally the project has actually been budgeted for a particular amount. Now, in terms of the financial management practices, we were expected to go and request National Treasury to be able to say, can we proceed or can we not proceed? And we looked at all these things and we realized we needed to stop. We did some investigations on some of them and so on. We opened some cases and so on. But there was one aspect we had not been able to do, and that was to quantify the actual work on the ground vis-a-vis what is being claimed. And this was because of the previous accounting system that allowed for us to be able to state what has been expended as what should be accounted for, as opposed to what is the value of this thing on the ground. We then had long discussions with the AG, and we agreed that what we need to do is to actually get a firm of independent built environment professionals who would then go through this process of evaluation and come to a quantified figure with regards to what is the value and what is not the value. And that has then costed us to incur fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So this fruitless and wasteful expenditure is not in relation to 2018-2019 financial year. It's related to projects that started from 2007, and they would range all the way until 2014, that was the last approval of that project. But these, when accounted for, they must actually be part of the books because we have not closed them, so they remain within that. And then what we have then decided to do is we declared that fruitless and wasteful expenditure as was identified by the AG. But there were two categories. The one category is projects that are deemed to be work in progress in the sense that we have not yet completed them. So those ones, we had a figure and we were happy with that figure, we were able to put it in. Then there was another category, which is projects that were deemed to be completed, but they had not been handed over to the beneficiaries. That category of projects, when they went to some of the sites, and a number of sites, they found discrepancies. So the report of the implementer and the report of the person who has actually verified what the implementer has said says that on site you will find this bottle of water. And then you get to the site, you actually find this cap, or you don't find the bottle, nor the water. So we then quantified that amount as well. We quantified the amount of the work in progress because we were able to evaluate at a time. They finished the process of this particular project, these other projects that I'm talking about, the ones that were deemed to be completed. The AG only finished the report a day before we submitted the books to Parliament. So we did not have the quantities for that at that particular time, which is why AG in the report, they would say that they were not able to ascertain the extent of the fruitless and the wasteful at a particular time, because we were not in a position to state it, because we have not yet sent the built professional to the site to do the same evaluation that we did with the work in progress. So that would be the process that we then undertake now, currently, the purpose of which is for us to be able to say this is the exact amount, and then it will be treated the same way we are treating the others, which is that we have appointed now, which I'm compelled legally to go through that process. We have appointed people that would then investigate each case, each individual project, who caused that fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Was it the implementing agent? Was it us as the department? And if it is us as the department, who in the department was responsible for that? Was it a third party who was supplying to the implementing agent and so on? So in some of these cases, even the cases that we had opened before, those cases did not have the quantification. So that information now, we are passing it on to the police so that it becomes part of their docket when they do the investigations and so on. The process now is underway in terms of looking at that level of detail. We will then take that information, and I would like to plead here with Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members that when we come back, we will then have to say, this is what we have done in terms of the investigations. This is what we have found. This is the consequence management that we have applied. And we therefore request that we get support of the committee to go to Treasury, for Treasury to assist us with the treatment of that fruitless and wasteful, so that it doesn't just recur. Because if we don't treat it that way, it is going to remain throughout all over the remainder of the year. So there will always be, even when it's deemed to be in a particular year, you've got a clean audit, you will still be having this amount remaining and not being treated in a particular way. So I thought I should spend a little bit of time on that so that at least I provide clarity as to what are these specific issues. Then there were issues pertaining to the books themselves. Modified cash standard is relatively new in government, and its application has not been as smooth from our side, and also in terms of the interpretation. So there are instances where we have an interpretation, AG does have some interpretation, and we have to go to the Accountant General for someone to say, this is what we originally meant, and this is what. So over the years, what we've been doing was to get a letter from the Accountant General that basically outlines what the interpretation is. But as time progresses, we are picking up that there are certain classifications that needed to be in a particular way. And this is where we had to do quite a lot of material adjustments. But subsequently, the statements project the correct picture of what the current state of the financial position of the organization is. But as we go forward, what we have then agreed with the AG on as well as the accountant, the office of the accountant general, is that we need to really sit all three of us and agree that this is what it is, so that as we state it, then we know. So a typical example, I'll just use an example, would be maintenance, which we were classifying as capital, and it is actually meant to be classified as current. So those were some of the, but we had to then adjust those things as we find them. But what it says is that it means from our side, we also need to make sure that there is a continuous training on this particular standard for people that actually put together that information. We saw in the during the audit, I'm sure Parliament might have noted this, quite a number of departments had requested to go beyond the normal June period to submit to Treasury. And this is largely around this capital-related project and how we treat these capital-related projects. Going forward in these issues, we have already now put in place, we are almost about to sign off on a panel of built environment professionals. These are the ones that are going to be our eyes on the ground. So what would happen is that once we have appointed an implementing agent, instead of myself going to a particular site without built environment skills and say, this thing looks good, and then come back and sign off and say, I'm happy with it, a built environment professional will go there on our behalf and then come back and say, the following two or three things have not been done correctly. We have started piloting that process, and we're using GTEC, built professionals, And then we will pay only on the basis of a very clear indication coming from a professional that says, there isn't anything that was not done according to what you have requested. So that's going to be part of what we will then deal with. We incurred irregular expenditure, and I would like to speak a little bit about this irregular expenditure, because it relates in the main, the first one, the procurement of goods and services over 30,000. This is issues of quotations. So in 2017-18, AG picked up that in some instances we would have two quotations, in some we would have one quotation. The reasons being that something would have gone to a particular number of suppliers, but the responsiveness of the market was not the same across the board. So in some instances you would find that two or three don't respond, one responds, and then we proceed. And they said, no, you would then need to further test. And we agreed with that. Then they declared it irregular. We treated that last year. But as they were going through that process, between the period 1st of April and the finalization of the audit, things were already happening at that time. So this particular category, they took what happened during that time before they could bring it to us, and we could then start treating it. And then we had to declare it. We declared it. It will be treated and so on. But it's an area that we have effected proper improvements. The second category of irregular expenditure related to, which is the 26.5, it's related to our implementing agents who are supposed to use the system that we use. Now, they got the normal quotations properly, but what they did not do is to apply the 80-20 principle. So when one element, however small, is not observed in that whole process of procuring, is then deemed irregular, and that is the context of this irregular. So these ones will be much easier to treat from an accounting point of view, so that they can be removed from the Treasury perspective. The other issue was this issue related to local content, and I think it is important that I flag it here, given the nature of the committee. we procured, and we procured office chairs and so on, we procured locally. And it had local content. But in the documentation for the tender, it did not state. So that also too is deemed irregular. So everything must actually be proper and in a manner that the prescripts are actually requiring of that. So we've drawn lessons out of this. We've put a matrix in place to be able to ensure that these things are observed and there's a tick for everything that we are supposed to be doing as we proceed. The issues around EPWP, there are some serious findings that were made by the AG. A bulk of this, I need to say, that we have already started addressing, not during this audit finding, prior to the audit finding. For instance, the issue I'm talking about with regards to getting the engineers and so on board, all those we are getting on the basis of work that we had done with GTEC and some of the previous investigations that we had done also, that just could not get to a point of quantification. So the capacity in terms of management of these projects and the oversight in particular, which is what I was talking about, getting that capacity on board. The records, so what triggered all this is when AG says, if you claim that a particular project is worth this particular amount, we have no problem with it, but show us the documents that the built environment professionals confirmed that indeed what has been done is worth this much. And when that was not produced, and indications then came to say, no, it's a 10-key solution. You are going to get everything from this particular person who is your implementing agent. All you're going to do is to get a key and you open the door and you are able to use the facility. And that is where things actually went completely wrong. And that's the part that we are actually attending to at the moment. The issue of feasibility, Honorable Chairperson, there are instances where, I think it was 2015, 2016, we had to say for each of these projects that we have found they've taken so much time and so on, we can't just proceed. We want to see the feasibility study. So the feasibility study was not there. And we then said, in the absence of such, then let us get somebody to go there and tell us that this thing is indeed feasible before we actually put any further money going forward. So that was done. And it was the basis for some of the progress, the projects that we were able to progress with. And they're saying we need to make regular visits to this site. I need to say here that those regular visits, for as long as they are not made by someone with a professional capacity in the built environment space, they would be fruitless and wasteful as well. We have to use people that would be able to say this is legit on the basis of it having been done properly and professionally. And the practices of implementing agents, which I've already spoken to. So we did that GTEC report and the other investigations, and we have concluded that. So the capacity that we are getting now to be able to deal with these matters going forward is based on that purpose. These built professionals are coming from across the country. Part of what our lessons here are is that you would find a project located in the Northern Cape, as an example, and you've got someone coming from, say, KZN to implement that particular project. I'm using those as examples. And when that happens, the challenge then becomes that someone comes here, does whatever they are doing, it doesn't go right, and they disappear. If you have someone who is a lot more local, that community would be holding that person responsible and accountable to some extent. they know who the person is, they know where the person lives and so on. It's very different, and that person would also think about their own credibility before certain things are done. We went to one of the projects over the weekend with the minister because we wanted to see what exactly we were looking at, the report about this project, and what we want to see, what is the reality on the ground. And it was bad. It really was not good. The person who did it comes from, you cross a couple of provinces to get to the province where the person comes from. So these are the dynamics of all these things. Financial information, we spent 98.8% of our budget. And there's an outline of the various programs and the extent to which they spent, as well as why they did not necessarily conclude that expenditure. Although I need to state that, because year after year, this is probably the amount that we would come with. It gets to a point where if certain contracts are pushed at a certain point, the likelihood of an over expenditure is very high. And the over-expenditure is illegal. So that's probably why you would find departments always come closer to this 99-ish%. And there's always going to be that variance. The next slide where you see that 57% of the tourism research and policy and international relations, in the main, this reflects the larger part of it is the budget of Southern Tourism. Which is a transfer from our side of about 1.274 billion. So what we had to surrender was the next flight, 27 million rands out of a total of a 2.261 billion budget. Then that's the slide I was talking to around surrender. I think we can then now go to program performance. In total, we achieved 83.75% of the target, which translates to 67 targets of 80 in total. Were fully achieved. Of course, much as we say, a lot of work was done for some, the 10 that we say, quite a lot of work was done. Sadly, we did not get to the very end, so it does not necessarily count, but the reality is that we had really made quite some strides in those particular targets, to the extent that some of them, I remember one of them was completed, I think, on the 2nd or something like that of April, just immediately after. The next slide just shows the breakdown of that particular performance. So corporate management contributed 82.35%. The tourism research policy and international relations, they could or not achieve but just one of their targets. The rest, they were able to achieve excellently. And then destination development, they had 84.62 and then 75.86 for tourism sector support services. Then we move on to program one. Here it's largely planning related information. Important to demonstrate that we observe what needs to be done with regards to keeping a properly governed environment, including proper oversight on the entity. This is the only entity that we are responsible for, which is South African Tourism. The vacancy rates, we unfortunately did not meet this target. It was 8%, a stretch target also, which you would recall that the overall target in government was set at 10%. So this particular one, the 9.1% that we ended up with, we did receive some money from Treasury in terms of they allowed some kind of environment to augment the budget for compensation. But unfortunately, we looked at that and we realized that it would not have actually been practical to still be able to fill that, but also to sustain it going forward, because we were mindful that cost of living adjustments, when they come through, they were going to wipe out that money again, and we are not going to be able to consistently be able to maintain that. So what the implications of this will be is that in instances that we don't really have to have someone throughout, we will then go for what I was saying, like the built environment professionals. We are getting those who will be on a panel as and when we are able to pull them able to pay. But we are not going to be able to keep idling capacity in inverted commas for purposes of seasonal projects and so on. We have a 50.7% at SMS representation of women. We also, and this changes from time to time, because it's you appoint one male, then it goes to 49. You appoint one female, then it goes back to so. But we are always within that range, 48 to 52%. That's what we try and keep. We are at 4.5% of the entire staff complement of persons with disability. Now, here we are talking about 21 warm bodies, starting from people that are at SMS level, senior managers, to people that are at lower levels. And then we've got representation at 95%, black meaning African, Indian, colored, combined. And then we have another target that we did not meet in full, which is the workspace skills plan. The reason here is because of matters related to the amount that we had in the compensation of employees. So normally we would give bursaries external, we would also give internship opportunities, and that was the most difficult thing to achieve on the basis that we did not necessarily have that money. So we have reviewed this even further beyond the time that we gave this other revenue. We have reviewed this, and what we have done now, we have advertised, but we are saying, particularly for even internal capacitation, if I want a bursary and I'm going to study something that is 2 years or 3 years, we are going to commit to the first year that we know we have money. So it should be the individual's commitment beyond that. If the money is there at a later stage, we will take care of that. But if it is not there, at least our contract is clear. The year that we've got the money, we'll be able to pay for it. So that's what we've done with regards to that. And then the management of grievances and so on. Here, one of the things that we pick up is that you suspend, you put an investigation process in place, you charge, and when you go on the day of hearing, you receive a resignation letter with immediate effect. And legally, there's nothing you can do. The jurisdiction is not there anymore. So, but ultimately then, the consequence is there, in the sense that when a person has to resign with immediate effect and not even, not even retiring, there's a lot of loss that the person incurs as well. So it's at the end of the day, there is some level of consequence management that comes with that. the issues around internal audit and all that, the system is fully functional with a functional audit committee and so on. The area of community outreach and the broader implementation of the communication strategy, unfortunately with this one, Free State, we had a we've got a beautiful lodge that we've built there. It's really one of the best. You can go online, you will find it on booking.com and then all other platforms. Mm-hmm. Vetsizook, at the top of the mountain. So, unfortunately, on the day that, 2 days before the launch of this, we were informed by SAPS that they don't think it would be ideal because the road that we have got to use to go through is the same place where there were some bit of protests and so on, and they were saying they don't think it is, let's reconsider. But we had put it right at the end of the year, financial year, so it meant that reconsidering it will have to go to the next period. So it seemed not to have been achieved on that basis. Yes. But what matters is that the lodge is actually there, and the lodge people can book and so on. So that's really the most important part. 100% we've achieved that in terms of procurement from BE compliant suppliers. Our range is from level 1 to level 5. Now we'll move on to problem 2. Problem 2, you will see here there will be lots and lots of reports. These reports, they assist us a lot in terms of being able to unlock issues that could be deemed to be constraints in terms of market access or proper facilitation of people visiting us and so on as tourists. So this problem, like I said, there's only one target that we were not able to achieve. But the remainder of the targets, and I will not go through each one in detail. If you see the one under the last one, the research seminar, I just want to demonstrate these things. What exactly do these things mean? The research seminar, we've got partnerships with universities, a number of universities. They do research on our behalf. We give them specific topics. Some of these researches are done by PhD students, some by master students, some are done by just pure researchers within that academic environment. These papers are then presented jointly at one session. That is what this research seminar is about, where the industry is able to pick up certain trends and so on and be able then to follow through with that particular individual in terms of the things that they're supposed to be doing and so on. So some of the things that come from there, we are able then to integrate into our planning in terms of how then should we be able to do proper developments of a particular area or another. The next one, the State of Tourism Report, is a report that I would encourage honorable members to engage with. So it gives us a total picture of what was the state of tourism at that particular time. From year to year, we also, besides the broader information about visitation, occupancies, and so on, we also select one individual area where we then go through some detail of what is happening within that particular area. We print this out. They are publicly available. They are also posted on our website, and they are available for members. Then we've got evaluations. So this program also evaluates the programs, other programs in terms of the work that is being done. So there would be, in terms of this capacity building, one is the programs that we are running largely through tourism sector support services that they then go through and evaluate, and they're able to then show us where we need to strengthen, where we need to improve and so on. But also it allows for better transparency in terms of what could be better. So this is information that is available if members need such information. And then we also do a report on the implementation broadly of the bilateral agreements. Then the next slide deals with development of a database for the purpose of the National Tourism Information Management System, which is part of a legal requirement. What we have actually done in this regard, we are doing an equivalence of a census of establishments across the country to be able to have better information for administration purposes, which in the process of collection also we observe the rules of managing third parties information. So issues about whether they would want that to be used for marketing purposes and so on, those are things that we are looking into. The idea behind this is that ultimately we will have one place where everybody knows these are all the tourism establishments in the country, and that would assist us also for planning and decision making in terms of investments to which areas and so on. We have a database also that we developed of black-owned products, and this we were also doing parallel with a process that would assist us in terms of market linkages between the small and big suppliers, so the tourism businesses and the small suppliers. But I'll talk about that a lot when I come to the next program. And then we also went through a process of development of biometric system for purposes of this. It provides service internally, but it is a lot more important externally, in the sense that it's meant to assist with. It's almost like a cloaking system at work. Let me put it like that. So when the EPWP workers come, then that the person came and the person left at the right time, and so on, those kinds of things, which will assist us a lot with regards to the kind of evidence that is required by the Auditor General. International relations, it was South Africa's turn to host, to chair the Indian Ocean Rim Association, and we have got a tourism chapter within that. So we had meetings of the experts across IORA, and that prepared a declaration for Nelson Mandela Bay. That's where the ministerial session actually took place, which outlines what needs to happen across the Indian Ocean. A bulk of the things that they've proposed are already contained in our ocean economy package, in that document that we are already rolling out. We host a best practice sharing workshop with countries that we have signed agreements with in the continent. In the main, it's really largely a capacity building exercise. It has worked well over the years, and it helps us not to have an individual country, to and fro, and which becomes quite expensive, trying to go and provide exactly the same support and so on. So we host them in South Africa, and then when they're here, we're able to go through all these different areas, whether it is how to deal with grading and classification of products, whether it is policy-related issues, and so on. The area that the program was not able to conclude, they were to recruit and train 600 youth that would assist with this project I was talking about of collecting data. And we're dealing with it across all the municipalities in the country, and we wanted people to come from those municipalities. Unfortunately, a few of the municipalities did not have graduates that had the requisite level that we needed. So what we are now doing is to, we had agreed with those municipalities that the neighboring municipalities could then deal with it, but it's a small number. So we ended up at 549 as opposed to 600 in total. Problem three, destination development. This is, again, is the program responsible for the capital project as well. It is really responsible for development of products, attraction of investments, and enhancement of attractions and so on. This is quite a lot of good work that they've done. But in the main, there was a lot to be done with regards to planning associated with the work around the oceans economy Pakistan. So we developed precinct plans for Khayelitsha, and this is largely around False Bay, the area around Zimbabwe, and the area around the Lookout Hill. And then we had plans for the Karoo region, and then a draft master plan for Sutherland to Carnarvon. We are looking at that particular area, Northern Cape. We're looking at that area largely around astronomy and how that interrelates with tourism. We do see a lot of people going there just to gaze in the sky. But we are now working with the Department of Science and Technology, and this is even before the minister came, because the minister is coming from Science and Technology. Even before the minister came, we were already working with Science and Technology to put together that particular plan. So there will be areas where people would be able to go there and gaze on these stars and so on. And then from Hondecliff Bay to Port Nolloth, there's a draft master plan for that. Most of them are going to be completed, the draft ones to be completed this year. And then Port St. John's, Eastern Cape, Port St. John's to Coffee Bay, Honorable Chairperson. It includes quite some big projects like Hole in the Wall. There's some big development that is planned for that particular area. We've been assisting quite a lot there, linking them up with the some of the DFIs and making sure that they are able to access certain instruments with regards to that. It's a long list, but you would note here that it is along the coast from the Northern Cape right up to the further end of the eastern part of our shores. I will then move on to the next project, the set of projects. Shangoni Gate and Palabura Wild Activity Hub. Shangoni Gate is it's a new gate near Giani into Kruger National Park. There were delays in this one, and in the main the delays were on the social aspect of the impact assessment. So the area, the specific area, is where the gate, around where the gate is supposed to be. There is two district municipalities border, two local municipalities border, two villages border, and two sub-villages. A village and a village, sub-villages border. So we needed to negotiate the exact locality that would not disadvantage either or. So we worked on that, and ultimately there was an agreement reached. which was quite a good agreement in the sense that there's a potential for the fence to be dropped and include a bit of land for that community to be able to put something inside the park that they can then be able to derive some commercial benefits from. So ultimately, some of these problems that we're experiencing have been overcome. The issue, so at that time, there couldn't be any appointment of these engineers and so on because it had not been issued in terms of the record of decision with regards to EIA. And on the basis of that, it becomes a lot more problematic because you could actually proceed only to find that you are acquiring services of people you are not necessarily going to use, and they will sue you for loss of income and so on. Then, while the activity up Bapalaburua, the impact assessment took longer. Subsequently, when they were about to conclude, something triggered a need for a hydraulic report to be included, and that required a whole other new process to be undertaken and so on. So we have gone back to on track in terms of this, and we will be giving you more details when we come here for the quarterly reports with regards to that particular project. And then we, in terms of issues of destination enhancement, there were assessments that were done of places, attractions that are government owned, but that are big attractions in terms of volumes and so on. And we were assessing the extent to which they are universally accessible with the intent to support so that we have got people, persons with disability, able to access these as well. I've outlined those, the Blade River Canyon, that's in Mpumalanga, Hluhluwe in KZN, Harip, the Free State site, and in the Eastern Cape, and we then went through the process of providing that support in terms of the infrastructure required. The other destination enhancement projects included the construction of a dinosaur interpretation center. They found fossils of a dinosaur in one species of in Golden Gate in the Free State. The construction of this is almost completed. It's quite a facility. It looks almost like Marubing in terms of the blending. So it would blend with the area. As you're driving past the road, you won't see a big structure. When you enter, then it's a whole different place. So that we're almost done with it. The Leopard Trail, that's a hiking trail in the Bavarian Kloof, and honorable members might have noted that the area now has actually been declared a heritage site successfully. We are also putting an interpretation center there. We are supported in these two projects by the EU. They are mega projects. We are supported by the EU. They are both really going very well. We are happy with the progress on site in terms of the work that is being done there. And then we have put signage, interpretive signage. So this is when you enter the place, then you would be able to get the full story about the place. We've put a lot of that signage. Kluhluwe Mfolozi, we have put that in Kambati, Dwesatwebe, and Tsitsikama. Tsitsikama, there's something which we did not necessarily put in here. It's also almost about to be completed. We did next to the big tree along the garden route. It's a big center with a restaurant facility just outside the Khoisan village. So it's actually going to supply that, and people also that are coming to the estuary on the opposite side. The other areas are the SKA node, the place. The one area where we had some challenges was the EPWP
in terms of the number of jobs. Now, this relates to training-related projects in the main. The way we use this program when it comes to EPWP, it serves as the bank. And then the other programs that have got projects that are EPWP in nature, then they will make their proposition and then it will go there. So there was a specific area which had two areas which had significant number of jobs, and both of them they fall under visitor services. The first one is the tourism monitors. So we're not able to recruit all the monitors before the end of the financial year. We have been able to sort that out subsequently. The second one related to hospitality, food safety. We were supposed to recruit 1,500 youth for that particular people, and we could not get the service provider out of the batch that has put their propositions and so on. So we have had to go back to retest the market and so on. And those actually led to this particular shortfall. It's an area that gave us some lessons, even in terms of how we manage the system with regards to making sure that the procurement process does not become the element that derails the actual progress that we need to achieve.
Sorry, teacher, can I ask you to have the remaining programs?
Program 4 is one.
Is it what? You've dealt with the human resource already?
It's the human resource. I dealt with it in the program 1. So
yes.
That information.
Okay. That's the last program. If you can do it until say 12, so.
Yes, I will be able to do it.
And then we use the 30 minutes for questions, and then another say 20 minutes for responses.
I'll be able to do that.
Thank you very much. Whilst at this stage, I'll ask the Honourable Mwema to take over.
Thank you. So we had we provide support so far. We would like the BEE Charter Council to actually have its own standalone mechanisms, but to get, you know, for them to be able to start and get functional and so on, we're providing support. So some of the things you would find here are things that you would have found also in their report. For instance, the monitoring of the implementation of the amended BEE sector codes. Because we paid for this, it has to appear here. Because we provided secretariat support, but we are not the ones necessarily monitoring. It is the council that is monitoring. And I think I need to make that point, because we can't be part of the implementers of the codes and be the ones that are also monitoring ourselves. Then we implemented our flagship program with the Women in Tourism program, which I need to highlight that it has also been noted by the United Nations World Tourism Council organization to draw lessons from it, which would then be able to assist in terms of building their own global one that they are busy with at the moment. We developed a framework for supporting tour operators, and around this is in the main to facilitate domestic tourism. What it is, in brief, it deals with making sure that we've got some sort of support mechanism to emerging tour operators that would enable them to access the market better. So you will, at a later stage, hear about certain areas that would be participating in that program. We would then get into an agreement with them, have a coupon arrangement, so that people that have booked through the groups that we have supported, they will be able to redeem those coupons, which then lessens the burden in terms of the price of the package that that particular person is selling. It hooks the market, and then at a later stage, people then are aware that this person is actually an operator, and then he can work out or she can work out the modalities of how best they can actually cut the market without that support. Support was also provided to designated groups in terms of accessing experiences, youth travel, the elderly and people with disability, and I think the DDG can speak a lot more, giving specific examples of the elderly that she has taken on those tours and the people with disability that she has taken on those tours and so on. And then the slide 44. We were meant to support 400 SMEs. We supported 663. We've put in the variance there in terms of how did we get to a lot more. In the main, it was good intergovernmental relations that led to that in terms of working together and creating enough awareness. On the contrary, we had an agreement with CEDA where we were going to support 400 enterprises to provide a very specific training. We were able to do 169, but CEDA experienced some operational challenges which their financial component of this could not be fulfilled, and as a result, we were only able to achieve that number as opposed to the original intent. We were supposed to support 3 incubators. We were able to support 4 incubators. An additional incubator came through, and this is MIR in Northern Cape. Honorable members would probably see today in the news there will be a lot about the Bloodhound high-speed car, the 800 kilometers per hour car that is actually going to be tested in the Springbok Pan. So this is the area in and around there that would be able to benefit out of that particular support that we have put in place. Then we have got another incubator that unfortunately we didn't finish it in time for the end of the financial year, but it relates to, we have a partnership with SANParks. The state of the facilities, we want that to be sorted in terms of maintenance and making sure that they are ready for the tourists and so on. And we are saying that the nearby communities around these parks, whether it's Ado, whether it's Kruger, the nearby communities must be incubated in terms of training with regards to all these particular skills, whether it's painting, whether it's plastering and so on, so that they will be the ones that are actually doing this. So that incubation is in relation to that. And then they will be able to then access that particular market. But we are mindful that in future, maintenance will always be there in that particular environment, and they would be able to get such opportunities, but also do other things themselves. In terms of our incentives program, we proceeded with the implementation of the market access program. To date, this program has supported about 432 entrepreneurs. They get support to go to shows, trade shows, whether it is our own in terms of Indaba or it's Meetings Africa or it's international, which relates to, for instance, the one that the chairperson was talking about, where the DM was supposed to be at the WTM. And then we also have the Tourism Transformation Fund. To date, the Tourism Transformation Fund, it has signed up a total of about 169 million in terms of support, of which 43.3 or so million
is the grant component that we have provided, and about 126.6 or so is the loan component which the entrepreneurs received from the NEF. And then I think the other things are things that we can really pass through. So if you take slide 49, we had intended to support the Vista Information Center in Paulson Jones, which we actually constructed, and unfortunately it was burnt down when there were some protests in the municipality with the workers and so on. So we had to change and divert our support elsewhere, but we still supported in the next slide Port St. John's as a town, which we are focusing on with regards to development of tourism in terms of service excellence broadly. Right, and then the framework for accreditation of tourism schemes. I need to highlight that one on the basis that this is something that is provided for in the Tourism Act, and it's something that we are doing with the National Consumer Commission. The idea behind it is that through that framework, a particular category of from within the sector can say, we would like to manage our consumer affairs, in inverted commas. So it's almost like an ombud scheme, but not quite an ombud scheme, if I could put it like that. So they would be able to receive complaints, and they would be able to facilitate the resolution of those complaints with the commission. Then the awareness campaigns, I think I will skip that, and we've done that. Right. Now, in terms of the national youth, that's slide 53, national youth chefs training program. We targeted 577. We ended up with 588. The reason for that variance of 11 is that we over-recruited to mitigate against potential dropouts, which happen in most of the programs. And then the Blue Flag program, we have got 200. We have targeted 200. For sommeliers, these are, well, it's not a fully fledged sommelier program, but it's really, it is on the road to become a sommelier. They are able to do proper wine appreciation and pairing of wines with meals and all those kinds of things. So this one is about 300 that we were able to enroll. I've explained the one about the 1,500 that we were not able to recruit due to the procurement challenge that I outlined. And then we have the hospitality program, which was implemented, and we had 643 enrolled in that particular program, which was targeting 600. The next one relates to the training that we, and this was the first time we're doing this, placing the youth in restaurants where they were going to acquire certain skills and so on. They were 1,780 that we were able to do, as opposed to 2,375. Northern Cape and Western Cape, those had not come on board yet, and subsequently we had followed through with those.
But I need to highlight Northern Cape, from time to time we do get a challenge of dropouts. In one instance we actually had a complete dropout from all the people that were there. One person was left and decided rather to move on as well. And when we look at where we think it's needed the most, it's actually there, but we are not sure what exactly could be the reasons behind some of these things. And then we've got under this slide 57, we did programs to either upskill or to train new tourist guides. That was Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, largely upskilling from the Kruger side, and then Ismangaliso, it was largely upskilling as well. Resource efficiencies. We have got this resource efficiency program with IDC, where we provide a grant and IDC provides a loan towards retrofitment of establishments. But what we decided to do was to recruit youth that go through a proper training to allow them to become assessors of those establishments. And upon qualifying, then they are the ones that go to the establishment, assess it, and then the report is part of what then goes with the application to say, yes, indeed, they are ready and they've already started doing certain things and they qualify or they don't qualify. So that is part of what we're doing. And then we do our sessions with local government in terms of capacity building. We've got different modules that we developed a while back with University of Pretoria, and we try to make sure that this is also part of that in terms of the levels of awareness, but also the kinds of specifics that they're supposed to do in terms of tourism planning as they do their IDTs. That would be the last slide in terms of thank you.
Thank you, DJ, for the presentation in terms of the annual report. I'll now open the floor for honorable members to engage with the report. I'll start with Honorable Moshoji and then Honorable Dango. Honorable Shoga, Honorable Wanda.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Let me start to thank the presentation that you received today. DG, let me also welcome the project that we're talking about in my province in the Free State. Yes, indeed, Honorable Chairperson. The project on Harib Dam. I know that project, I was there for many, many, many times, DG. It's true reflection what we are just presenting to us today. The only one that I don't know is this one of Lodge. I think it's going to be part of my oversight, just to go and check what is happening there. Thank you very much, DG. Honorable Chair, my first question, I just want to check, DG. Can you explain the reason for not having strict measures in place to avoid future occurrence of regular expenditure? The second one, Honorable Chairperson, the Auditor General indicated that you do not have credible asset register. So can you tell us how are you going to account for immovable asset in your department, DG, if you don't have a register? The third one, Honorable Chairperson, SA tourism entity only achieved 56% of its key performance indicator. How is the department conducting oversight to help this entity? The last one, Honorable Chairperson, on page 8. During the financial year criminal investigation into allegations relating to some of the EPWP were being undertaken by the law enforcement agency. I just want to check how many of these EPWP employees DG and how far about the investigation. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mushuri, Honorable Dango.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you to the department and the DG for the presentation.
I think there are some matters of concern. When we speak about irregular expenditure, it's one thing. You have awards, it's irregular expenditure, you haven't budgeted for it. But when you're talking about wasteful and fruitless expenditure, that becomes a matter of serious concern. That raises red flags because it can't be explained away, it can't be corrected, it's lost already. How do we actually curb that kind of expenditure and that kind of reports? Now that brings me then to the question of the Internal Audit Committee. Did the Internal Audit Committee pick this up? Did the Internal Audit Committee red flag this? Because that kind of expenditure is in fact not good. Irregularly, you can fix, you can correct it, you can have corrective measures. For that, you can't have corrective measures. The second issue, Chairperson, that I'd like to raise is the question of training and the question of presentations outside. Now, I was deployed outside, and one day a person from tourism came to this particular country. I was not aware of the customs in that particular country. Took and pasted a presentation that they had made in the UK maybe a couple of days before and presented it there. Fortunately, there was somebody there from the Free State who picked it up and corrected the whole perception of what South Africa was about in that particular country. But it says a lot about people's preparedness when they come into particular countries, about customs, about people-to-people tourism, I think, is important. And how do we develop that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Dango, Honorable Boshoff.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to add on to what the two previous speakers have been saying. We are all concerned about these fruitless and wasteful expenditures, and I hope they can expatiate on what measures are going to be put in place. But if we go back to South African tourism and the irregular expenditures that they've incurred, I mean, in 2017-18 it was 4.1 million, and 2018-19 it's 98 million. Where was the oversight? Who was meant to oversee this expenditure? How did you allow it? It clearly shows to us that there's no oversight. The other thing that I picked up was that the minister said that the CEO, Mr. Nchona, was suspended and the investigation is now completed. It was completed in July. Can we get some feedback on what was the outcome of the investigation, because we're now in November, so a report should be forthcoming to this committee. It would appear as if Mr. Nchona spent money without condonation on the Cape Town International Jazz Festival. Is this so? If so, will criminal or, what's the other word? Civil cases be implemented against Mr. Nchona? And then the minister also said that she would be replacing both the board chairperson and the deputy chairperson of the board. Could we be informed whether this has taken place or whether there are still discussions on the go? Then I'd like to know the Tourism Amendment Bill. We need to be provided with set timelines on whether, on when it will be finalized and tabled in Parliament so that we can get this process going, because it could have an impact on our tourism figures because it includes the Airbnb aspect that everybody is talking about, and people with Airbnbs are very concerned about what could happen, and it could add to the unemployment rate. Could we just have some feedback on the Northern Cape Platfontein project? 3.5 million disappeared, livestock and game disappeared, and every time somebody wants information on it, this department refers, the province refers you to national, national refers you to somebody else, and nobody gets concrete answers on it. Then I would also like to know what this department is doing. Is it in discussions with the South African police services, because we know that crime is having an impact on our visitors? If you have a look at a report that I googled the other day, it says here that visitors from the UK is down by 4.9, from the United States it's up by 0.9, thank heavens for that. Germany is down by 14.1, France is down by 9.6, the Netherlands is down by 1.8, and Australia is down by 8.9. That should already be red flags in the Department of Tourism. What discussions are taking place with your ambassadors so that they can promote South Africa? Because as Honorable Dangor said previously, the messages going out to people abroad are not always the correct messages. We need to be given feedback on what message is going out. And then, DG, you kept referring to your implementing agents. I would like to know whether we cannot have a look at putting more stringent measures in place to vet our implementing agents, because they seem to be the downfall on many projects being implemented. So if we could just get a report on that. And my last question, on slide 22, you spoke about your black representation, 95.5%. Great. Could we have a breakdown of how many are black, how many are colored, and how many are Indians? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bishop. Honourable Lodge.
The first thing I want to ask is, how do you actually measure your success? Because in the past, you were one of the departments that we praised the most and said, listen, it's actually enjoyable when you come and present to us. But you have gone backwards over the past few years. So how do you then define that? Have you been successful or not? The other thing, we're sitting with, I think last year was 29.1% of that is the unemployment rate now. Youth unemployment is sitting just under 60%. Now, if we can attract tourists, I am not against the promoting of the domestic tourism. That should happen. But it's the international arrivals that actually boost significantly, because they spend, have a lot more to spend, they've got stronger currencies to spend, and that's in decline. So actually you are not helping to address the unemployment by moving backwards, as you yourself said, want to move forward. Something, we went to Marupeng last 2 weeks ago, and we've got some fascinating historical sites, and you referred to some of it as well in the East Free State. We've got Mapungubwe up in Limpopo, we've got Bloemfontein in the Southern Cape. There's so many of these that can be linked. What are you doing to actually, from your side, making sure that we link things like that to ensure it's not just a Limpopo running on their own, or Free State running on their own, or Gauteng, or even the Western Cape? And make sure that when you attract these people, you make it easier. We actually package deals that can link people to such routes.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Honorable Lund. Just on a few questions also from my side. The first one relates to licenses of tourist operators.
which obviously I think I would need a closer collaboration with the National Public Transport Regulator, particularly with the outcry of some of the accredited service providers, that sometimes it takes ages for those licenses to be renewed. Is there any interaction that that the department is having with the Department of Transport, so that at least we're able to make use of, I think it's Regulation 38 of the, yeah, I think it's Regulation 38 of the National Public Transport Act, which says that can be, that could be done in 24 hours. Just want to check what is it that we're doing to make sure that at least we avoid the negative impact on the on the image of the country, particularly when the transport is impounded by our traffic officials. The second one relates to the issue of project management in the department. Clearly, I think the assumption is that there is a memorandum of agreement between the Department of Public Works as an implementing agent of the infrastructural programs. What could have led to the department not making use of that avenue? Because clearly, I think in your explanation of both the irregular and fruitless, I think you consistently raise an issue of the built-in environment capacity as an area of concern, or also as a contributory factor that could have led to this challenge. The second one relates to, and the third one relates to the stimulus package. What is it that the Department of Tourism received as part of the stimulus package to also boost the tourism sector as part and parcel of our commitment to ensure that the tourism industry plays its critical role, informed by the fact that it's one of those sectors that has been on the positive slide. The fourth one, you made reference to CEDA as having contributed to the underperformance, which I suspect probably the funding part mostly is provided by the CIFA. CEDA will do the business plan and then probably table the funding proposal to CIFA, which in most cases will then will have stringent rules. I just want to get clarity whether is that the point that the department was putting across. No, thank you. Let me give over to the DJ.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you very much. I think DDG Corporate Affairs will deal with the demographics. Yes. You have to be on the record as having provided clarity. Then the CFO will deal with the systems issues. I will still come back to them as well, but he will deal with how are they doing this and what could have happened and so on. And then there's a number of questions that I think DDG Sector Support Services would have to attend to, including the very last question that you raised in that order. I'll come back to the other issues.
Thanks, DJ. The breakdown in terms of racial classification is that we have Africans at, this is as at March, we have the percentage of Africans at 86.3%,
with colors at 5.4%, Indians at 4.4%, and then whites at 4.5%. I don't know if... okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. On the irregular expenditure, most of our irregular expenditure, as explained, was because of our implementing agents, which did not follow the same procedure as government. They did go through a quotation process, but they did not apply the 80-20 principle. So it is a very technical issue, basically. From our side, what we've done now is we have drafted delegations for the implementing agents, which we will now distribute to all of them, so that they do comply. We will also provide training to them, so that they do comply with the 80-20 principle to avoid this irregular expenditure. With regard to the asset register, I think it is listed under the audit finding as an asset register, but it is actually the work in progress of the implementing agents, because that is classified under the departmental assets. So this whole problem of the value of the asset of what is already constructed, that was not correctly on our asset register. That is why that finding has arisen.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start first with the CEDA one. CEDA, we had a partnership with CEDA over 2 years, in terms of assisting our SMMEs to be trained on financial literacy. They have an Italian company called Empretrack, which provides tutors to assist with this financial literacy for SMMEs. So within our partnerships, we were expected to do the logistics side of things in terms of venue, in terms of the travel for the non-officials, that is the tutors, but from their side, they were expected to make sure that for the 6 days of this financial literacy training, they need to pay for the tutors. Unfortunately, they were not able to do that because they had pressing issues and the money was reprioritized to other CEDA projects. But it's a partnership that was worthwhile because it was the first time when we find people in business who stay fully for 6 days because it really made value to them. And it was the training that really assisted them to be able to have their financial accounts properly done so that when they go out to get more funding, at least their books are in order. On tourist crime, as a department, from towards the end of last year, we expected to come up with a strategy in terms of tourist safety. And it's not a strategy that was developed by the department alone, but it was developed by various stakeholders, the industry, the business were part of that. We were able to come up with a strategy which addresses three areas. The first one being the precautionary measures that we need to take to stop the crime from happening. And when we react, that is the second one, where we find ourselves having to really assist the tourists in distress, what are the things that we need to do? And the last one being the aftercare. Normally you find that most of our international tourists, when they've gone through this, most of the time they want to go out, go back immediately. but now we want to make sure that we follow up with them if it's a crime that has been opened with SAPS. We're able to also get feedback so that we talk to them. And that did help in the sense that some of them, they really do come back, even if they have gone through this hardship. We have SAPS being part of the forum. Currently, we have an MOU with SAPS, which we are collaborating on in terms of ensuring that we are able to deal with these crimes against tourists. One of the things that we have done is to identify the hotspots, to link up these hotspots to the various police stations, so that when they do their patrols, they're able to also go into these attractions. But added to that, we have what we call tourism monitors in all the 9 provinces, including Sunparks as well as Sunbe, where they're able to give information to tourists in terms of what to do and not what to do. That is on the safety issues. The other area was on training, which I had a little bit of difficulty understanding as Honorable Danko was putting this one forth, but our training.
So that's more, it's related to if we are going to send someone to speak to a particular market, how do we orientate that person here at home?
Okay.
Such that when they get there, they are able to represent us correctly.
Okay. Which is for SAT. I won't be able
fine,
to.
Fine, I will take it. You should be able to respond. You should be able to respond.
What I might indicate is that in terms of the ambassadors, fortunately, I was involved in where the ambassadors were being posted to engage with them in terms of, as tourism, what are the things that we are doing, and out there, what is it that they can really do. But at the same time, we're able to pose, to ask questions. But in that space, I was also with an SAT official.
I will take the question. I will respond to the question.
Okay. I think these were the questions.
I will respond to the question.
That were within my space that I had to respond to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Let's allow the DG. The DG will fill in the gap.
I was just worried that if DDG says that she can't respond, and there's been a question about whether we do oversight, it could reinforce that perhaps we are not, but it's not her program that deals with oversight. So I thought I should put that here. She deals largely with domestic issues, by and large. So the problem that deals with that, the DDG is not here. So I thought that that's important to just put that disclaimer. Let me start with Honorable Tango's question. I will use an anecdote to try and explain it. 2 weeks back, we went to China. So in the sauna, there were 3 markets that were identified specifically in the State of the Nation Address. It was India, China, and Nigeria. Now, part of what we then made as a proposition was at a leadership level, given the sensitivity of some of those markets, at a political leadership level, the minister would have to go at the very least to India and China, but particularly China, because they recognize political authority and they have a way of channeling, let me put it like that, channeling tourism to particular markets. They are largely driven through most of those large operators are actually state-owned enterprises. So you have to engage with the leadership. what we then picked up was that engagements were taking place, but unfortunately, those engagements were taking place with people that are dealing with the operations. So what you get is information that says, yes, we are going to put it in the brochure, we are going to make sure that you are marketed and so on, but you are not getting the feedback that is coming from someone who has to make a decision about your market. So those are the people that we were able to sit with, get a sense of what are the issues from their perspective. And some of the issues that you are raising here, Honorable Chairperson, are issues of the nature of communication. And they are saying, to an extent, we are our own worst enemies. The nature of communication about ourselves into those markets. They were saying it's something that you would not ordinarily find anywhere else in the world. So most of the negative message comes from within, and we send this through social media and so on, and as it gets there, then they decide whether they are going to send someone there or not. But then, how do we prepare those people? So there is a SA host training that SAT goes through. We take these people that we send to, we call them hubs, that we send to be in charge of specific hubs through various trainings about the market, about the diplomatic aspect of it. It's not something that we started a long time ago, but it's something that we have noticed there was that particular gap. 5th and 6th of December this year, Minister will be meeting with all the hubs in one place. We have not done this before. And part of what we are going to be doing is to bring the other relevant departments across government, whether it is protocol training, whether it is understanding the relationship between the interests of South Africa and how you present those interests, understanding how do you become the extension of the diplomatic community, in inverted commas, because we are in an effort of essentially making sure that all of us are promoting South Africa. We then also try as much as possible to make sure that they are not running with things by themselves without being in touch with the various missions, their commissions that are in those countries. So if you take a person that we've got in China, that person will interface with Ambassador Ngonyama in Japan, would interface with Ambassador in China, would in that particular way, and would make sure that these information feeds and so on, this interface with a person who's supposed to be dealing with issues that pertain to visas, that is the Home Affairs person that is there and so on. But it's work in progress, because most of these people would have come from industry, not from government. So the orientation would not necessarily be a government type orientation. It would be an orientation of someone who facilitation of market, I will have a meeting with that one and so on. But at the same time, the nuances of each of these markets are completely different. They are those that recognize state authority, and if they don't see it, things don't move. And there are those that would want to just have a direct interface with the person on the ground and so on. There are some that are even telling us that much as we want to go digital, there's a lot of people that would still want to go with brochures, normal brochures. And they are saying this is what they want to see. There are people that are going to the missions, they want information, and that's where we need to feed that particular information and so on. So that work in progress is what we are working on and making sure that ultimately, and we're taking them through normal processes like getting through the security clearances and so on. And I do understand what impact, Honorable Dango was saying, the impact of that engagement not being culturally sensitive. That's really the core of it. So as a result now, even when we send people, I would give you an example of the Middle East. We've got two specialists on that. They have lived the culture. They speak the language.
they understand the environment in its entirety. So whether we are dealing with investments, whether we are dealing with bringing in tour operators to invest here with regards to bringing the numbers to this country from a halal tourism point, they understand that dynamic completely. So that's we have bent our fingers a few times and we've learned some lessons. But this is good feedback from someone who was in a mission and who has had direct experience with this, and I think we would also take that into account and look at what is it that we might have actually done in that mission previously. There is a lot of very critical questions. I should start from the beginning. Are we doing oversight on SAT? Yes, we are. As a matter of fact, this element of the AG report that talks about the irregular is as a result of the oversight in the main. But then there's a thin line between oversight from the political authority and the responsibility of the board. So if you look at what that report says, it says that there was a contract in place. That particular contract had a provision for renewal. The renewal was beyond the required 15% by the rules. So it then becomes irregular. And what should have happened is that it should have been authorized by National Treasury. So when you're sitting somewhere in Pretoria, there is no mechanism in place that can prevent a board decision to go and approve or not approve. That's the point I'm trying to make. You will be able to see it at a later stage, and you will then be able to ask the relevant questions, which minister did. And once those questions have been answered, you satisfy yourself or you are able to point to a gap that exists within the system. But there is certain responsibilities that the board takes, the executive within SAT takes, and then that can then be taken by the oversight responsibility of the political authority. So those were really the issues. Minister actually flagged this thing with the AG directly and said, I've got this report out of the investigation. It has flagged this. I can't allow you to conclude this particular report and say in good faith that there is, you talked about 4.5, it was still there. So was it, how much was it? Was it
9. 1 and it's up
no,
to 98.
This year it was about 9 before it became that. So she said there's no way that she's going to just sign off this thing, have a nice report, when she knows that there's something. And that's the point I'm trying to make about whether there is oversight or not, going into the details and being able to do that. She has gone to, within this short period, she has gone to meet with all the staff of SAT. She has addressed all the staff. It was part of the culture that we would like to bring on board, is to ensure that the staff at SAT also feel that they do have a political authority, but they also understand that they are an entity of government. The processes and systems that we use apply to all of us. Because it is easier when you are in an entity to start feeling like you are not necessarily in government as such. So the agility is about being able to do things quicker and better, but not necessarily not doing things as a government. So that, and I think we find each other well. There was a question about the board. The appointments and so on. There hasn't been new appointments yet of the chairperson and the deputy chairperson. There is an interim chairperson. His name is Ravi Nadasen. He's doing a good job, and is currently in that acting ship, and then the process to get the replacements for the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, that is underway, that particular process. Maybe I must just conclude all the questions that came from Honorable Oshos before I go to there. The bill, I can only say that it is going through NEDLEC. It is going through NEDLEC. So the NEDLEC process can take anything from 3 months to 6 months. And that is as per their prescripts. So we'll have to go through that process with the social partners and so on. And out of that, then it comes back for approval by cabinet and so on. So I can't quite put my head on the block for this one. It's not in my hands. It's in the hands of that particular system. But if you work out that if we are able to do it in 3 months, then we should be able to still go to cabinet and still be able to come here beginning of April, somewhere there. But I can't quite say this is. The CEO currently is undergoing a disciplinary process. I think it's best that we leave it at that.
According to the minister, the investigation was completed in July, and we are in November, so something should be forthcoming.
Yes, I think the disciplinary hearing is in process.
It's completed in July.
No, the investigation was completed in July. After the investigation, now it's a disciplinary process that's unfolding.
So just to give a bit of comfort on this matter, the investigation was conducted, concluded. The board sits and it makes specific requests to the minister to proceed. I can confirm, because we have reported this before, minister gave her concurrence. That process of disciplinary has commenced and it's underway. That's where we are at.
Chairperson, on a point of order as the whip, I'm just concerned we're running into 1 o'clock and we could be losing members here at that particular point in time. Just
I think the intervention that the whip has made, I think, is proper. Can we probably agree that the outstanding questions that must still be responded to?
I can run through those. They are very short. They are very, very short. It's whether internal audit is on top of these things. Yes, okay. It is. They raised the flag, and we were able to pick the flag and then worked with the AG. So they exchanged notes also with the AG. So they are on top of those things. The livestock issues and Northern Cape in particular, the livestock part is not ours. What we did was to build, to renovate the old farmhouse and make it a lodge. That
let's do this because we're still on Honorable Boshoff's responses. It's agreed that there will be written responses so that you are then able to hit to the advice that the WIPAR is making. I think they are correct. There is an urgent meeting that you need to attend in E249. So let's then agree that we close it on the note that the written responses will be provided, and that we will then share the information. I know that it's Honorable Boshoff, it's Honorable Lund, it's also my questions that must still be responded to. But our apologies to the Honorable Members. Let me take this opportunity to express gratitude to the Department for the presentation that they have made, convey our appreciation to the minister for flagging those wasteful and fruitless expenditure to the AG so that they can be thorough work on that. Indeed, means there's work that is happening because it has not been detected in the last 5 years. So I think we must appreciate that. Maybe what you could probably then do, thank you DG and the team, you have excused. Let's deal with the minutes of the last meeting, honorable members. Honorable Dango moves for the adoption. Honorable Mashodi. Thank you. Let's just get clarity on the gambling.
Okay, good. Afternoon, members. As Chairperson indicated, the week of the 18th to 22nd of November, the